Hello, Mark.
Come in.
Hello,
Mark.
Sorry, the clock's broken. I'm trying to.
We noticed you hadn't changed it.
Sorry.
We could there start we that again.
Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 18 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we'll interview Graham Binns from the Mars Project at Canonical, and we'll read your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat thing on the website and in the UPC IRC channel on Freenode. I'm Mark, and joining me remotely through the wonders of the internet are Tony.
Hello.
Laura.
Hiya.
And, oh, Alan's not here.
Oh, he's still on holiday.
There's a big empty sofa here.
Yes.
With an Alan-shaped
dip in it.
Yes, so hopefully that little hiccup there is the only factor you'll notice of me being remote this time.
Yeah.
You're still not so well then. That's like a whole other week.
They do stick around these bugs, don't they?
I think I'm on the mend.
Good.
Are you in quarantine?
No longer.
Oh, good.
I'm allowed out of my bubble. So, Tony, what have you been up to since last we spoke?
Well, since last we spoke, rather nice thing, actually. It was my mum and dad's Ruby wedding anniversary.
How many is Ruby?
40.
Gosh.
So that's quite good. And it's more than my age. So that's so good. No, it was really nice, actually. You know, lots of friends and family teamed up and, you know, gave them a bit of a do, as they say. My dad had a remote controlled wireless shark. Which he flew around the hall.
Flying remote control shark.
Yes, yeah, sort of airborne.
Oh, yes, thing. I've seen one of them.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't what instinctively came to mind when you say Ruby wedding anniversary, but it seemed to go down quite well. Lots of people...
it's not what springs to mind when you say remote control wireless shark either.
But lots of people were enchanted by it, so who am I to comment? But yes, they're probably listening to this, so yes, happy anniversary, Mum and Dad.
And how about you, Laura?
I finally upgraded my personal laptop to 14.04 last weekend.
All go well?
Yes. Well,
I noticed your hesitation.
Well, that went fine. It's the Dell XPS 13 Developer Edition Ubuntu pre-installed laptop, and it was on 12.04, and because it had to have lots of extra packages provided by Dell. And it's got a backported kernel.
Right.
And I think it was the backported kernel bit that meant that I either had to upgrade or I could just upgrade the kernel bits with this extra hardware support. And I figured, I'll just upgrade to 14.04, not really thinking about it. And of course, because there were all these extra Dell packages on in the first place, that made the ordinary upgrade not work very well. So
Dell providing updated packages for 14.04 for the extra bits it needs?
They're all in the repositories now.
Oh, okay, brilliant.
Yeah, so that was the thing. I think they had all these ones from the separate repository and they were all conflicting with the new ones.
Right, I see, yes.
So I should have thought about that really, but I couldn't get the X part of the operating system to run. So I figured rather than faffing around for ages and probably... because all these packages weren't working, I actually managed to just reinstall it. And that bit was fine. Copying data off and back and stuff wasn't quite so quick, but the actual installation was brilliant and it just works.
Cool.
And then today I had the screen replaced.
What about you, Mark?
I rescued some Super Nintendo games. Sometimes around my area people leave stuff like on the grass verge outside their house, which they're getting rid of, a sort of informal free cycle thing. And someone had left a box containing a SNES and a load of old games out in the rain. So I figured that it was unloved and uncared for. And they'd left some really classic games. So I'm going to crack out my SNES from the loft when I get the chance, having verified that they're not full of water. One of them looks like the battery's leaked all inside it. So I might have to replace that and clean it up a bit. But other than that, I'm really looking forward to it. It's all games like the original Donkey Kong Country and The Legend of Zelda and a load of like really classic titles, which I never actually had.
Tony's looking really excited about this.
Yeah, I know all about those things.
It's not really.
Next time you're over, Tony, we'll have a game of Super Mario Kart. How about that?
Okay, that sounds good.
You can only play that on the Nintendo Wii.
Yeah. Right, okay, cool. Well, it sounds like everybody's had a busy week or so. Let's get on and talk to Graham Binns.
On the phone, we have Graham Binns, software engineer at Canonical. Hi, Graham. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. We've spoken in the past about work you've done. I think we talked about Launchpad, but you've moved on to different things now. I understand you work on MAAS. Is that right?
I do, yes.
Right. So MAAS, M-A-A-S. I'm a complete idiot. Tell me what MAAS is.
Okay. So actually, I Googled this before... before you filmed
Hang
me.
On,
that's more research than we've done.
that doesn't bode well.
Well, I wanted to know if we were at the top of the list, and we are, but also Google gives me the definition that MAAS, M-A-A-S, is a South African, presumably Afrikaans name for thick, naturally soured milk. That's not what I'm here to talk about, but I just find it interesting.
I fear we may have the wrong podcast.
milk as a service. Anyway... So MAAS or MAAS or MAAS or however different people pronounce it, there is no canonical correct way of doing it. No, that was not an intentional pun. It stands for Metal as a Service.
Is this John O'Bacon's new band? Then?
Which basically means that we can take, using MAAS, you can take hardware servers, a rack of servers, two racks of servers, however many you happen to own, and... start treating them as though they were machines in the cloud. So you can start spinning up machines as you need them, deploying workloads onto them, and then when you're done with them, tear them down until the next time you need them, do something else. That's the quick version.
Right. So, you know, you could probably already do that with other software. What's the unique selling point of MAAS that, you know, I know there are data centers around the world that have servers in them where there are workloads on them. And I'm pretty sure that happened before MAAS. So what's the USP of MAAS?
The USP of MAAS is that the real USP of MAAS is the fact that it talks to Juju. If we to overstretch a metaphor to the point where it's about to snap, MAAS is the device driver to Juju's operating system. So,
moment while we think that through.
We're processing that.
I did say it was overstretched.
Right.
So, the difference between, say, using the, really to get the best out of MAAS, you need MAAS plus Juju. And the difference between using MAAS and Juju versus, say, a bunch of Chef scripts or Puppet scripts or what have you, is the fact that Juju allows you to consider services rather than individual units. MAAS provides a huge amount of automation to abstract away the fact that you're dealing with different hardware architectures, different disk sizes, and so on. So when Juju asks for a machine, or when, you know, MAAS has an API, so it doesn't have to be Juju that uses it, but when someone asks for a machine, they say, I need a machine, and it has to have this much RAM and this much disk space. MAAS is responsible for finding that machine out of all the pool of machines that are available, and starting it up and returning it to you, saying, there you go, you can do with it what you like. Now, Juju on top of that then allows you to deploy the workloads. So it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. Being on the MAAS team, I would love to say that it's all MAAS, but the magic really happens as a combination of the two.
So I'm still in my head, I'm not quite able to conceptualize it. How does it either differ from or relate to or form part of something like OpenStack?
Okay, let's... a great example of this actually is the... are you familiar with the Canonical Orange Boxes?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so the Orange Box is 10 Intel next unit of computings, units of computing. and the way that MAAS would work there is that it sits on one of those nodes, node zero, and it knows about all the other 9. Mm-hmm. It knows their hardware specs, it knows their MAC addresses, it knows how to turn them on, turn them off, and it knows whether they've been assigned to a user, what have you. Once you've got that set up and you've got Juju set up to talk to that MAAS instance, what you can say using Juju is essentially Juju deploy OpenStack. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but for the sake of a quick hand wave. And then what Juju does is it goes away and it says, well, I need one machine for this, please, Maz, and I need another machine for that, and I need this spec here. And Maz is responsible for starting those machines up and saying, yep, there you go, Juju. And Juju can then do the work of deploying stuff onto them. Now, the upshot of that is, as Mark Shuttleworth demonstrated at the last OpenStack Summit, using a combination of Maz and Juju, you can actually deploy an entire OpenStack on one of those orange boxes in about 25 minutes.
Right. So you're starting from... You've got a head start in that one of the nodes is already installed with, for example, Ubuntu and Maz. So you're not going completely from zero, are you, in 25 minutes?
No. But in actual fact, from the point of installing Maz to having a working Maz cluster, with the exception of having to download boot images, which takes a while because we have to... boot the nodes once with an ephemeral instance of Ubuntu that we then throw away, that just so that we can inventory them. With the exception of that, you can get from an installed Ubuntu to a running Maz cluster probably within half an hour very easily.
So you said you boot Ubuntu on them ephemerally to audit them. So
yes.
So in the orange box, you've got one node that is the controller that has all the brains, and then you have the other bunch of machines which are initially are blank, and you've pixie booted them and they net boot and install, it runs, it gathers information and then feeds that back to the Maz controller that has a database of these are all the nodes that I know about, so that when you come along and want to deploy a workload, it knows what nodes are around. Yes huh.
That is exactly what happens.
I think he's got it, man.
Yes. The sound of the other shoe.
So is it, hold on a minute. So if you've got Maz, is it like virtualization but plus a lot more management, or is it?
It really depends. When Maz is working properly, you should never have to know about it.
Right.
It's one of those things. It is a bit like virtualization, except that you're using real machines. So it will provide you. It provides exactly the same things as virtualization does. So you can say, I need a machine with this specific set of parameters. And of course, in really complex data centers, that could also mean I need a machine that has this kind of CPU or this many CPUs, and it needs to have this much disk space, and it needs to have this much RAM, and it needs to be on this virtual network.
Right.
And Maz will take care of all of that.
So, when going back to the question of virtualization, I would envisage someone has one or more servers, and they might install something like Xen or VMware or something in order to get, or use KVM in order to partition that single piece of tin into multiple machines into which they can deploy different workloads at different times. Are you saying Maz is only going to deploy one workload to one physical machine at a time? And I can't carve it up in the same way that I could with one of the virtualization options.
In actual fact, you can. I can't remember off the top of my head what virtualization options we support. But what Maz can do, for example, although it can't do power control on LXC containers, it can know about them because they're just another MAC address on the network.
Right.
So if you want to carve up a machine, you can allocate that machine to yourself, set up the containers on it, and then tell Maz about the containers. And Maz will know about the containers, and when Juju asks for stuff, or when you request a machine in your, whatever script you happen to be writing, you can get one of the containers back. So you can carve up workloads in that way if you choose to.
And does it know that it's a container on a physical host, and that, if I throw all the workload at these 10 VMs or containers, they're all going to be, killing one host rather than spreading them out nicely?
It doesn't, but that's something that we're hoping to work on either in this development cycle or the next.
Yeah, we should get on that. That would be good.
Yeah, our main focus for the next two cycles is robustness. That's one of those things. We would love to We have a kind of philosophy of we can't, because we're producing a tool for sysadmins at the end of the day, and sysadmins being almost uniformly a very smart bunch of people, we can't protect them in the same way that most software can protect its users from shooting themselves in the foot, because they're going to want to do things that are inherently dangerous,
like destroy a machine.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
But we are. One of the things that we want to do is make Maz more robust in the face of failure, because occasionally right now it isn't. But also we want to put safeguards in place so we can essentially have the sysadmin say, I want to deploy this workload. It is the equivalent of saying, I want to do this -- yes.
Right. No. So once I've got my workload deployed, let's say, for example, I've got one of those funky orange boxes and I've deployed a workload, and then I want to send it somewhere else, like into the data center, rather than, because this orange box has got to go back, and I want to do it for real. I've done my development. I want to push it somewhere like sane. Am I talking, I have to go and get a bunch of machines in my data center, or can I throw that workload at like Amazon EC2 or HP or Azure or something? Do I have to have physical hardware?
This is where the magic of Juju comes in, because you would be building your workload using Juju. So Maz is literally giving, is all that Maz cares about is giving you back the hardware that you need, and you do all of the orchestration work in Juju. One of the most disappointing, not disappointing, but most annoying things when I'm talking about this stuff is that Juju used to be called Ensemble, and orchestration and Ensemble go really well together. And Juju is all about magic. and it's not, I don't think it's magic, but it's very, very cool. And what would happen is you'd sort your workload out, you get it working, you tune it exactly how you want. You can then from Juju save what's called a bundle, which is essentially a set of scripts that tells Juju how to set this workload up. Right. And then you can use Juju in, I think we pretty much support every cloud going. I know that we certainly support Amazon, Azure, HP Cloud, and I can't remember other things that it works on. But you could then throw that bundle at Juju in another cloud, and it should just spin up.
Or you could set up your own private cloud and throw it at that.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're setting up your own private cloud again, using Maz to inventory the hardware and the virtual machines that you've got it carved up into is the way that you would make it all sit together.
Okay, so this all sounds awesome in a hypothetical situation, and it does all sound very magical, right?
Yeah.
Are people actually using this, and what kind of workloads? What are they actually using it for?
People are actually using it.
Yay!
There are some that we can't talk about for various reasons, all of which are in very, very small print and in language that I don't really understand. People are using it. It tends to get used. Maz and Juju tend to get used there's pretty much every single workload that I've heard of so far has had to do with big data.
So Hadoop and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Doing Terasorts and so on. But also we're starting to hear a lot now about interest from telecoms. Okay. For the combination of Maz and Juju, because they are now moving into a cloudy kind of space for providing their services. And Juju and Maz gives them real flexibility with the hardware that they've got.
So, you're talking about big data, like large companies with large volumes of data. How can you, when you're developing Maz, how do you replicate that? Do you have before the Orange Box existed, you just have a bunch of old PCs hooked up together, or do you have a data center in your house, Graham? How do you do this?
I do not have a data center. Our test rigs at the moment are like a scaled down version of the Orange Boxes, but the way that we have tested sort of big data workloads and things on Juju and Maz has been using Canonical hardware provided by our lovely and wonderful IS team, led by the estimable James Troop.
Mm-hmm.
And we have we have access to quite a lot of different types of hardware. The ones that we test things out on a lot are fairly bog standard servers, so just, you know, Intel x86 boxes with a BMC attached so that we can do power control. But we also test things out on C-Micro clusters and such like. And it's actually running Maz and having Maz handle your server properly is now part of Canonical's certification process. So if you bring out some new server hardware, we want to see that Maz can deal with it properly. And if it doesn't deal with it properly, then we'll either fix Maz, or in future, if it's something that, you know, the hardware manufacturer should have done in the first place, then we would say to them, yeah, we can't certify this as it is.
So it does sound like you can go from like something as small as a NUC up to, you know, big data centers full of lots of machines. Are there any like extreme limitations on like how many machines on the network you can discover and manage, or what limitations have you found with it so far? Like the boundaries.
We haven't found the limitations yet. I can't remember the.
Have you looked under the sofa?
We have. What I would love to do is one of the things that I would love to do is just get somehow connect loads of C-Micro clusters and Orange boxes and just racks of stuff all together and power them on. I should imagine that when you do that, because Maz is kind of it's a slightly modular architecture, so you have a region controller that sits on the top, and that provides the web interface and the API, and then you have cluster controllers that talk to the region controller, and the cluster controllers manage a set of nodes. And I should imagine if you connected, you know, the machines of everybody plus dog to a cluster controller and then turn them all on at the same time, the cluster controller and the region controller would fall to their knees fairly quickly. Right. One of the things that we're going to be doing as part of the robustness work is stress testing it, essentially.
Cool. And so, and this is all free software. What's it written in?
Maz is written entirely, he says, thinking about it, in Python. I think we've gotten rid of all the bash that was in there. There was some horrific walls of bash that we spent a long time getting rid of. It's all Python. It's Python and Django. Django provides the framework for
the web stuff,
For the web stuff and the data model and such like. Occasionally that causes us to run into some grief because it wasn't really designed for this kind of application, but it works very well 99% of the time. Juju is written in Go, which is a wacky fun language that is quite fit in my head. The bit of Juju that talks to the Maz API, that's also written in Go. That's a separate project called Go Maz API.
And all of these things are on Launchpad, I guess.
They are indeed, yeah.
And it's all free software.
Yeah.
Awesome. Amazing.
Where can people go to find out more?
If you go to launchpad.net/Maz, you can get the code there. To find out more, visit Maz, that's maaz.ubuntu.com.
Cool. Magic. Thank you very much, Graham.
Yeah, thanks for talking to us, Graham.
Take care.
Cheers then. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
It's time for Command Line Love, and this one was submitted by a listener, Tor Gausen, who was written in to tell us about the command RL wrap. That's RL wrap.
Mark.
Yes. Yeah, Mark, please tell us what this means.
Yeah, so it took me a while to work out what this actually does. So imagine you have a command where you run the command and it then gives you a prompt for some input, and you type some text. And then you type the wrong thing, and then you press the left key to go back, and then it inserts a load of escape characters, and then you fail miserably, and you hit Control-C and start again.
Happens every day.
Yes. So what you could have done there is you could have preceded your command with RL wrap, which then wraps it using GNU readline, which then gives you better line editing. So it means that you can do things like navigate it with the keys and press up and down to scroll back through history and things like that.
Okay. So it sort of replaces the entry bit of the program with a better one?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay. What are the useful ways you could use that other than the things you've described?
If you don't have Nano on your system?
Well, it's not really a replacement for a text editor. It's really, it's for when you're inputting text into a prompt in a command line utility.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, you know, I've written a script which reads in various bits of text for doing various jobs. Like, it's a DVD ripping thing which then asks you which chapters you want to rip and so on. And so it could be useful for enhancing the prompts in that. But there's a few examples that Tor's given us, such as, you can use the history from a previous session as well by giving it the flag dash H.
So if you're knocking together a quick and dirty bash script, you could call either your whole bash script, I guess, or bits of a bash script using RL wrap and make it a bit more user-friendly.
Yes.
Interesting. So there's a link that Tor sent us, which we'll put into the show notes, and then you can find out a bit more about how to use RL wrap and how to make it work for you. That's the end of the command line, love.
And now it's time for your feedback. We've got an email from Jana or Jana in Bangalore in India, who started listening, or is actually regular listens now to the podcast, mostly offline during a commute to the office. I really love the Ubuntu podcast. I love Ubuntu and find this podcast is the best on this topic. Also, you cover the breadth of it with all topics related to Ubuntu and not just Ubuntu. And now, for the weirdest reason why I like the podcast, I find your laughs not irritating. That's a good...
it's a good reason to listen, yeah.
I hear other podcasts like Twit. What's that one? Twit.
This Week in Tech.
Or This Week in Google, and they laugh so much, but I might not get the American joke or phrase, and I'll be like, what was that? So your podcast is really soothing to my ears and pleasant.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. Yeah. Nice. It's always nice to hear from people who listen around the world as well.
Yeah.
It makes it really weird for us.
It's really cool. Yes. I do always make the effort when someone makes me laugh not to laugh directly down my microphone.
Yeah.
And I think it worries me that I'm bursting some poor listener's eardrums in the process.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, and it's good that somebody doesn't find our laughs irritating. So.
And Mike Bartosz emailed in, I just joined the Ubuntu 12.04 crew this year and am loving it. Really easy to use, and so far does everything I've wanted, including running Oracle XE, Tomcat, and Eclipse. You were discussing alternatives for Ubuntu One a wee way back, but no one mentioned Grive, which is Ubuntu's answer to GDrive. I've installed this and it works well. It saved me having to have another account with another provider and yet another password.
Okay, so GDrive presumably is the thing that allows you to use your Google Drive for storing stuff.
Yes.
And
Grive is an open source client for syncing files with Google Drive on Ubuntu and the other Linuxes.
Yeah, I don't think we did mention that. So thanks for emailing in, Mike.
And it's a good point as why he wants to use it, because, I mean, pretty much everybody has a Google account for one reason or another. So it is kind of handy just to be able to not have to go to another service and sign up with them.
Yeah.
You can just say, oh, I'll use that login I've already got, and you've got all the space.
Yeah, nice one. Thank you, Mike. And Dr. Jellyface said on Twitter, I'd like to say hello.
Hi, Dr. Jellyface.
Hi, Dr. Nice Jellyface.
I wonder if that's his real name, and I wonder if he's a genuine medical doctor.
Or she?
Let us know. Yes, this is true. I assumed, didn't I? I'm naughty.
Jellyfish is such a masculine name.
Yes. Well, perhaps Dr. Jellyface could let us know and confirm one way or the other. Anyway.
And, if you are a medical doctor, I've got this thing on my back, which I could really do with you. Please, can we stop?
Ooh, quite disgusting. And that's the end of your feedback, thankfully.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that enthralls, exasperates, or elevates you, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. Please do get in touch. I mean it. Just one message, just to know there's someone out there who cares.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. Our next show will be on Wednesday, the 6th of August at 8:30 in the evening.
Is that PM?
UK. PM.
8:30 PM local time UK.
Yes.
In the evening.
Yeah.
Yes. 20:30.
Standard by five.
Isn't that a speed?
Oh, sorry. Yes.
I don't know. Well, thank you for joining us, Mark.
How many parsecs is it?
It's, I don't know, the Kessel Run, I don't know, there's a geek reference in there somewhere.
Did I hear Alan earlier?
Yes, you did. You did hear Alan. You might have hit on our little secret.
Where is he?
Aren't we supposed to have stopped talking by now?
Yeah, a long time ago, but that's fine. So you might have heard in our little interview segment that we did earlier with Graham Binns, one Mr. Alan Pope. That has given away the fact that that interview with Graham was actually recorded during the last live episode, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We kept it back. We were so excited to be able to talk to him. We kept it back for another couple of weeks. And hence Alan being in it. But hopefully Alan will be back actually with us in person, filling his gap in the sofa in the way only he can for the next live shows, which are in just two weeks if you're listening live. Or
1 week.
Six days if you're listening to the download on the day it was released.
Which one?
This one.
Oh yeah, this one.
Right, it's definitely time for us to go. Bye-bye.
Bye.